content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the February 16th and February 23rd, 2026 edition of the New Yorker, The Race to Give Every Child a Toy. For most of history, parents couldn't buy their kids dolls, action figures, or the like. Then playtime became big business, by Alexandra Schwartz. If you were an immigrant kid in New York at the turn of the 20th century, the candy store was the center of your world. You went there to kibitz and schmooze, to get away from the crush of tenement life and the glare of the beat cop, and, of course, to eat sweets, Tootsie Rolls and chicken feeds and as many chocolate pennies as a copper one could buy. Should you have walked by the candy store at 404 Tompkins Avenue in Brooklyn one November morning in 1902, you would have spotted something stranger, but no less enticing, a small brown bear gazing solemnly back from the front window. As the story goes, the stuffed animal was the brainchild of Morris Mictum, the shop's owner. A few days earlier, newspapers had published reports of a hunting trip that President Theodore Roosevelt took in Mississippi. Roosevelt had wanted to shoot a bear. A tracker caught one for him, bopped it on the head with his rifle, and tied it to a tree. The president was not pleased. Where was the honor in killing a subdued and wounded animal? The cartoonist Clifford Berryman sketched a humorous version of the scene. Roosevelt magnanimously turning away from the roped bear, which looks more like a startled puppy with two pom-poms stuck to its head than it does a creature capable of mauling a grown man to death. Mictum was born Moshe Sharmatz in what is now Belarus. To help him dodge conscription by the Russian army, his family announced that he had died of typhoid and pretended to bury him while he sneaked out of the village to start a new life. He trained as a rabbi and, more practically, as a machinist before coming to the United States in 1888 at the age of 18. Berryman's cartoon struck a chord with him. Apparently, the president of his adopted country treated wild beasts better than the Tsar treated the Jews. It seems to have been patriotic, not commercial instinct, that led him to ask his wife, Rose, to sew a version of what he called Teddy's Bear, which she did using scraps of mohair and wood shavings from the candy shop's basement. Mictum's teddy bear, the apostrophe soon disappeared, ignited a craze. He hadn't intended to sell the stuffed animal, but everyone seemed to want one. At first, he got some neighborhood yeshiva boucheurs to help him sew more of them. When they couldn't keep up with demand, he took a prototype to a textile factory. Mictum didn't bother to patent his invention. The imitators merely spurred interest. Children loved the teddies. So did fashionable women, who toted them around town as a chic accessory, la boobus avant la lettre. The teddy craze was followed by a moral panic, as crazes involving kids inevitably are. Students in a New York University sewing class were forbidden to make teddy bears, lest they breed idleness among children. A Catholic priest in Michigan went further, preaching that if little white girls were allowed to play with, quote, the horrible monstrosity, end quote, instead of dolls, they would fail to develop their maternal instincts and doom the race to suicide. In fact, as Michael Kimmel describes in his new book, Playmakers, the Jewish Entrepreneurs Who Created the Toy Industry in America, the teddy bear was good for dolls. It was good for toys of all kinds. Before the teddy bear, the toy market did not exist in the sense that it does now. For much of the 19th century, dolls were made at home from corn husks, clothing scraps, and the like, or produced from expensive, fragile bisque porcelain and kept high up on shelves to be admired by grown-up collectors, not pawed by clumsy kids. Most children had marbles, hoops, balls, and little else. few people bought toys from stores. The success of the teddy bear changed that, accelerating off a race to supply kids with the accoutrements of their leisure. Today, parents will not be surprised to learn the American toy business is valued at roughly $42 billion. Kimmel is a distinguished professor emeritus of sociology and gender studies at Stony Brook University, where he founded the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities. His other books, of which there are many, have titles such as Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era, and The Gender of Desire, Essays on Male Sexuality. He began writing Playmakers as a family history. Morris Mictum was his great-great-uncle on his mother's side, though he inherited none of the teddy spoils. His own great-grandfather, Mictum's half-brother, never worked at Ideal, the toy company that Mictum founded. As Kimmel poked around, he discovered that Mictum was hardly the only immigrant or first-generation Jew to have had a major part in the development of the toy business. Hasbro, the company behind hits like Mr. Potato Head, Transformers, and My Little Pony, was founded by Hillel, Herman, and Henry Hassenfeld, three brothers who fled pogroms in Kishinev and arrived in New York just after the teddy bear debuted. Joshua Lionel Cowan, born on the Lower East Side to Jews who came from the border of Poland and Lithuania, created Lionel Trains. Louis Marx, a round, bald little man who was proclaimed the toy king of America by Time, was the Brooklyn-born son of Austrian Jewish parents. Model airplanes, hula hoops, tiddlywinks, and even Chinese checkers turned out to be Jewish creations, and the list goes on. Few of the inventors of these toys enjoyed what could be called a carefree youth. Many came from grinding poverty and squalor. Yet, Kimmel argues, they ended up shaping American childhood as we know it. The first great wave of Eastern European Jewish immigration to the United States began in 1881, set off by virulent, violent anti-Semitism in the Pale of Settlement. Between studying the Talmud and running away from the Cossacks, the Jewish children escaping to America had not had much time for play. But kids in the U.S. hardly had more. In 1850, only half of American children over five attended school. The other half worked. The Puritans cast a long ideological shadow. Leisure bred laziness. Coddling meant spoiling. Play was considered to be a snare of the old deluder, Satan, the first step on the slick road to hell. Then, at the end of the 19th century, came the Progressive Era, and with it, momentous cultural change. Certain traditional ideas about child rearing still prevailed. Kimmel quotes from one popular manual published in 1916 that advised quieting a crying baby by flipping it over and administering a vigorous spanking. Repeat if necessary to get results. But a growing cohort of reformers and psychologists believe that beating a baby might not be the best method to encourage its development. In their view, children were not wild, wicked things who needed to be tamed. Rather, as Kimmel puts it, they were happy, curious, and playful beings in need of cultivation on the path to maturity. At stake was nothing short of the future of the species. The reformer Felix Adler, summing up the new thinking, wrote, "The human being requires a period of preparation extending over years before he is ready to take up the struggle for existence." Adler was born in Germany, but moved to New York when he was six, after his father became the rabbi of Temple Emmanuel, that bastion of Manhattan's Jewish upper crust. This son of privilege did not limit his concern to his own kind. A secular humanist, he left his father's congregation to found the New York Society for Ethical Culture, where he later established a free kindergarten for children of the working class. Adler was a particularly passionate crusader against the scourge of child labor. How could kids grow properly if they were forced, from their earliest years, to toil in factories, on farms, or in mines? The child must develop mentally, and to do so, it must be sent to school. The child must develop morally, and to do so, it must be kept within the guarded precincts of the home, Adler wrote. The child must develop physically, and to do so, it must play. These words date to 1905, but Kimmel attributes their ethos to ancient, enduring Jewish attitudes about the sanctity of childhood and the innate preciousness of children. Jews did not believe that kids were naturally inclined toward evil. According to the Talmud, childhood is a garland of roses. Kimmel neglects to note that the phrase spare the rod and spoil the child is based on a line found in the Hebrew Bible's book of Proverbs. No people is perfect. The Jewish parents' job was to cultivate this bounty to help each blossom thrive. In the 1917 book, The Jewish Child, the physician W. M. Feldman quipped that Hillel was the forerunner of Montessori. In fact, the first Montessori school in the United States was founded by the psychologist and educator Margaret Naumburg, another child of German Jewish immigrants, at the Henry Street Settlement House on the Lower East Side. Everywhere you look in this formative period of American childhood, you bump into German Jews. Here is George Hecht, who had a nice Manhattan upbringing. He lived in a brownstone in Midtown, which his grandfather built, and went on to found Parents Magazine, and with it, the genre of the child-rearing advice column. There is Sidoni Matzner-Gruenberg, who immigrated from Austria to New York as a teenager and, as a young mother, threw herself into the new field of child development, eventually leading the Child Study Association. In 1913, she published Your Child, Today and Tomorrow, a best-selling parenting guide that aimed to serve as a corrective to the arbitrary rules of American attitudes toward child-rearing. These people came from bourgeois families. Their parents had status. One of Gruenberg's grandfathers was the mayor of his Austrian town. Another was a wealthy grain exporter. Above all, they were modern. For them, the Society for Ethical Culture was a more important affiliation than any synagogue, and they were less likely to take inspiration from the religion than from the kindergarten movement that was part of their German heritage. The Jews from Eastern Europe were different. They didn't come to the world of play as theorists and educators bent on improving other people's lives. They came as hustlers and inventors, eager to better their own. The Eastern Europeans, Yiddish Jews, Kimmel calls them, were poor, wretchedly so. They were numerous. More than 2.5 million had arrived in the United States by 1924, when the imposition of drastic immigration quotas stopped the flow. And they were culturally alien, viewed as strange and sinister, not least by their co-religionist uptown, who put so much store in assimilating into American society. It is arresting, in light of both the Yiddish Jews' subsequent success and the repugnant demonization of immigrants today, to come across the following passage in Playmakers from an 1893 New York Times article documenting a visit to the Lower East Side. It reads, "This neighborhood, peopled almost entirely by the people who claim to have been driven from Poland and Russia, is the eyesore of New York and perhaps the filthiest place on the Western continent. It is impossible for a Christian to live there because he will be driven out, either by blows or the dirt and stench. Cleanliness is an unknown quantity to these people. They cannot be lifted up to a higher plane because they do not want to be." Actually, they did want to be. There is a reason Morris Mictum moved his family from the Lower East Side to the row houses of Brooklyn as soon as he could. When his youngest son was born in the back of his Tompkins Avenue candy store, he named him Benjamin Franklin. He might as well have fastened the baby's diaper with a flag pin. Others went farther. After arriving in New York, the Hassenfeld brothers struck out for Providence, Rhode Island, where, in 1923, they founded a scrap textile business, making fabric-covered boxes for school supplies, and later, pencils to go inside them. Eventually, one of their kids had another idea. Why not put pretend stethoscopes and pill bottles into the boxes and sell them as toy doctor's kits? Hasbro was born. When Felix Adler wrote of the necessity of play, he wasn't referring to toys. He meant physical play, sport. The Playground Association of America was founded in 1906 to give city children a place to play besides the crowded, dangerous streets. The Boy Scouts followed in 1910. But as Mictum discovered with the teddy bear, the priorities of the new childhood, coupled with the growing prosperity of American society, had also created a demand for material playthings. Dolls were an obvious place to start. In 1897, the psychologist and educator G. Stanley Hall, it was he who came up with the idea of adolescence as a distinct phase of life, he produced a study that showed playing with dolls to be psychologically beneficial for children. At the same time, composition, a new plastic-like molding material made from sawdust and glue mixed with additives such as resin, cornstarch, and wood flour, was being developed. This meant that dolls could be mass-produced to be handled. Mictum set about to create what he called an unbreakable doll. For his model, he chose the Yellow Kid, an Irish street scamp character from Richard Oakalt's popular comic strip of the same name. The Yellow Kid was a big, bald baby of a boy with jug ears, a gap-toothed grin, and a long yellow nightshirt. Kimmel calls Mictum's choice to make a male doll novel. I think he may be overrating Mictum's ingenuity. Yellow Kid dolls had been manufactured for nearly a decade before Mictum's hit the market in 1907. But the earlier dolls were crude, lumpen things, a cross between a beanbag and a sculpted potato. Mictum's actually looked like the imp from the cartoon, and it sold like gangbusters. Constant competition in the burgeoning toy business meant constant innovation, more bells, more whistles. In 1920, Ideal came out with Flossie Flirt, a flapper baby doll with marcelled hair, rubber arms, they feel almost as soft and as smooth as your own, and eyes that rolled in their sockets. She was followed by Snoozy Smiles, which had two faces, one happy, one sad, and a voice box that imitated baby sounds, something that Thomas Edison had tried and failed to pull off three decades earlier. One of Mictum's more notable technological advances came with Betsy Wetsy, a doll whose development Kimmel characterizes as an engineering nightmare. Mictum persisted, ending up in 1937 with a doll that could drink, sniffle, cry, and pee into a diaper that little girls delighted in changing. Betsy Wetsy was a triumph, Mictum's last. He died the next year at the age of 68. His son, Ben, took over as chairman of the Ideal Toy Company. When I was a kid, I liked toys because they helped me make believe, Ben told one journalist. And what I wanted to make believe was that I was grown up. In the mid-50s, Ideal considered producing a toy bound to make little girls feel very grown up indeed, a Marilyn Monroe doll. Ultimately, the company passed. What would an adult doll do? 3 years later came Barbie, designed by Ruth Handler, the youngest of 10 children born to a Jewish blacksmith who had immigrated from Poland, and brought to market by Mattel, the company she ran with her husband, Elliot, also a first-generation American Jew. So, why did Jews thrive in the world of toys? The most obvious reason is timing. Until the 20th century, Germany controlled the toy business. That changed with the embargoes and boycotts of the First World War, exactly the time that Eastern European Jews were getting their American foothold. But Kimmel wants to find a distinctly cultural answer, too. He draws tenuous connections. He ignores inconvenient facts. He talks about nachas, the Yiddish term for the pride parents take in their children. He blurs his focus to cover the well-trodden territory of the comics business and the Jewish artists who channeled their acute sense of outsider status into creating characters like Clark Kent, who could simply shed his nerdish trappings to become the all-American Superman. Making people happy is a serious business, true. But making children happy requires having the ability to think like a child, Kimmel writes. It requires resisting that biblical admonition from 1 Corinthians that growing up means one must put away childish things. The rise of novelty toys, gags like fake vomit and dog poop, whoopee cushions and snakes in a can, he attributes to an immigrant Jewish male imagination, puerile, juvenile, gross, and funny. Tell that to Soren Sorensen, Sam Adams, the Danish immigrant who is credited with inventing many of the same contraptions, along with some 600 others, including sneezing powder and the joy buzzers. The question of provenance can be tricky when it comes to toys. Imitation is inherent to the business. Barbie was famously based on Build Lily, a German doll marketed as a novelty for adults. Even the origin of the teddy bear has been the subject of dispute. Everyone wants credit for a hit, for a flop, not so much. In 1958, Ben Mikdum thought he had a winner on his hands, a baby Jesus doll to sell at Christmas. He traveled to Rome to get permission from Pope Pius XII to manufacture it. An extraordinary photo in Kimmel's book shows Mikdum and his wife stiffly posed next to a Vatican translator and the pontiff. Amazingly, Ideal offered the church a royalty, as if the Holy See owned the rights to the likeness of the Savior. There is a photo, too, of the doll itself, a nude little cherub packaged in a box designed to look like both a manger and an illuminated Bible. The baby Jesus doll turned out to be a failure of the Jewish male imagination. Nobody wanted one. The big toy that season was a pliable putty invented 20 years earlier by a man with the distinctly non-Jewish name of McVicker to clean coal soot from wallpaper. Then rebranded for children as Play-Doh. Toys changed American childhood. But did they change it for the better? The argument in favor is unsurprisingly as old as the industry itself. Dolls have long been said to breed curiosity, not to mention empathy. G. Stanley Hall believed that boys playing with dolls would encourage them, later in life, to be kinder to their wives. Dolls for boys did eventually take off, though one doubts whether G.I. Joe, introduced by Hasbro in 1964, under the comically masculine label of action figure, had Hall's hoped-for effect. In the post-war period, toys were relied on to reinforce the prevailing social message of the day, that girls were girls and boys were boys. Gender, the male one in particular, is Kimmel's specialty, and he is good on the topic. He notes that many toy ads in the 50s showed fathers and sons playing together with model airplanes and tanks that mimicked the war equipment that the men had known firsthand. It was the time of the Lavender Scare, of Rebel Without a Cause. Bonding with their fathers through play, it was thought, would save boys from homosexuality and juvenile delinquency, and, at the same time, re-domesticate the fathers who had returned from the excitement of war to the stultification of suburban life. Toys were even implicated in the country's race problem. In the 1940s, the psychologists Kenneth and Mamie Clark conducted their famous doll tests, in which black children from both the North and the South were given four dolls, identical save for skin color, and asked to evaluate them. Give me the doll that looks like a nice child. Give me the doll that looks bad. The subjects overwhelmingly preferred the white dolls, leading the Clarks to conclude that prejudice, discrimination, and segregation had damaged black children's self-esteem. Findings that were later used to support the Supreme Court's ruling in Brown v. Board of Education. A few years after the Clarks published their study, Sarah Lee Creech, a white florist from Belgrade, Florida, became obsessed with the idea of creating a black doll that would, in her words, represent the beauty and diversity of black children. With a friend, she photographed nearly 500 black school children to develop a range of realistic skin tones for the toys. One enthusiastic supporter of Creech's effort was her fellow Belle Glade citizen, Zora Neale Hurston, who introduced her to influential black leaders like Jackie Robinson and Ralph Bunche. Another proponent was Eleanor Roosevelt, who called the dolls a lesson in equality for little children. Creech's doll, produced by Ideal, was named Sara Lee, after its white creator. The plan was to release four versions, each with a different skin tone and hairstyle. The first came out during the 1951 Christmas season. The New York City public school system appointed Sara Lee its official doll. The magazine Ebony raved that, quote, a transformation has taken place in Toyland, end quote. But sales of the doll lagged. A technical problem with its pigmented vinyl led to a recall, and Sara Lee was soon taken off the shelves. Kimmel blames Ideal for having sabotaged the toy with lackluster marketing. It surely didn't help that stores like Saks and Macy's did not stock Sara Lee for fear that black customers would scare white ones away. Mainly, parents wanted toys that would make their children smarter. They still want this. Kimmel tells us of early 20th century German critics who complained that overly realistic toys, intricate dollhouses and train sets and such, would suck the blood out of the minds of children. One post-war play school catalog came with an essay by a child development expert from the University of Chicago, which admonished parents to buy not merely educational toys, but ones that were correctly educational so that they teach the right things at the right time in the right way. Parental anxiety has become only more acute, and toy companies are happy to indulge it. By the time I was babysitting in the early 2000s, Baby Einstein was the rage. In 2007, a study in the peer-reviewed Journal of Pediatrics reported that parking a baby in front of the company's video programs not only failed to encourage precocity, but in fact caused language delays. These days, parents may turn to LoveVary, a subscription-based company founded in 2015 by two friends in Boise, Idaho, that provides parents with age-appropriate bundles of toys designed by experts for your child's developing brain. This is all well and good. I, an American parent, thoroughly enjoy playing with LoveVary toys. So, I think, does my son. But as well-intentioned as these companies may be, they exist, after all, to make a sale. In her celebrated parenting guide, Sidonie Gruenberg warned against the propensity to shower a child with toys far in excess of what he can use or enjoy. Simple things would better stimulate the imagination. Try some sticks and stones, she suggested. See what happens. My own child had a birthday recently, his third. He enjoyed opening his presents. The next day, I found him playing with an empty cookie tin that he had filled with a plethora of Q-tips and proclaimed treasure. Q-tips were invented in 1923 by Leo Gertzenzang, an immigrant Jew from Warsaw. Children are inventors too, and they are always one step ahead. Next, from the February 18, 2026 online edition, Silicon Valley's favorite doomsaying philosopher, Nick Land, believes that digital superintelligence is going to kill us all. In San Francisco, his followers ask, what if, instead of trying to stop an AI takeover, you work to bring it on as fast as possible? By James Dusterberg. In the spring of 1994, at a philosophy conference on a rundown modernist campus in the English Midlands, a group of academics, media theorists, artists, hackers, and DJs gathered to hear a young professor give a talk at a conference called Virtual Futures. It was 10 o'clock in the morning, and most of the attendees were wiped out from a rave that had taken place in the student union the night before. But the talk, titled Meltdown, was highly anticipated. The professor, Nick Land, was tenured in the philosophy department at the University of Warwick, at the time one of the top philosophy programs in the UK. Land had gained a cult following for his radical anti-humanism, his wild predictions about the future of technology, and his erratic teaching style. Soon, his academic presentations would become increasingly experimental. At a conference in 1996, he lay on the floor reciting cut-up poetry in what an attendee described as a demon voice while jungle music played in the background. But that day, he just stood up and started speaking, his thin frame twitching under an oversized black jumper, his voice soft and halting, slipping at times into a whisper. "The story begins like this," he began. "Earth is captured by a techno-capital singularity as Renaissance rationalization and oceanic navigation lock into commoditization takeoff. Logistically accelerating the techno-economic interactivity crumbles social order in auto-sophisticating machine runaway. As markets learn to manufacture intelligence, politics modernizes, upgrades paranoia, and tries to get a grip." At the time, few people had any idea what he was talking about. For most, Land's prognostications were easily dismissed as the ramblings of a tech-addled continental philosopher. By 1998, burnt out on stimulants and anticipating a Y2K apocalypse, Land had a breakdown, left academia, and dropped off the map. A quarter of a century later, the world has changed. AI apocalypse no longer seems so far-fetched. Land's visions of a technological revolution that abolishes the political order now appeal not to a marginalized academic ultra-left, but to the rising Silicon Valley-aligned new right. And Land, in recent years, has re-emerged as one of the most influential reactionary thinkers of our time. His thought has filtered into the highest levels of the tech world. Marc Andreessen, the founder of the behemoth venture capital firm A16Z, referred to Land as his favorite philosopher. And people who work in Silicon Valley told me that an increasing number of reading groups were featuring Land's work. Land began to gain a new following in the early 2010s when he became a key figure in Neo-Reaction, an intellectual movement that unfolded largely in the hinterlands of blogs and was a crossroads for the emerging strains of the online far right. In a long essay published online in 2012, he gave the movement a philosophical grounding and a catchy name, the Dark Enlightenment. Like Curtis Yarvin and other neo-reactionaries, Land abhors democracy. Politics since the Enlightenment, he argues, is a story not of the advance of human freedom, but of constant resource transfer from the productive to the unproductive. A world historical tragedy of the commons that would eventually spell its own doom. Land's main contribution to this discourse was to find a radically anti-human, science fiction-inflected optimism in democracy's end. He projected a future where the post-war order collapsed and uncontrollable digital superintelligence led to runaway economic growth, a rapid hierarchization of society, and the eventual rule of transcendent force that he called techno-capital or simply intelligence. In 2008, the academic Benjamin Noyes coined the word accelerationism to describe Land's vision of capitalism as an unstoppable force and traditional politics as its enemy. The term was first taken up by leftists who argued that unfettered technological progress would lead to a fully automated socialist utopia, and then by neo-Nazis who imagined fomenting social breakdown through terrorism. By 2022, when the machine learning revolution had entered full swing, some in Silicon Valley began to talk of effective accelerationism as they advocated removing any political or moral checks on technology. Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, posted on X the following: "You cannot out-accelerate me." Andreessen published his widely shared Techno-Optimist Manifesto, calling for the conscious and deliberate propulsion of technological development to ensure the techno-capital upward spiral continues forever. In 1993, Land had described capitalism as an invasion from the future by an artificial intelligence that had come back in time to assemble itself from enemy resources, that is, mankind. 3 decades later, many in Silicon Valley are starting to believe that superintelligence is on the horizon and approaching fast. If AI takeover is inevitable, then maybe resistance is futile. What if, instead of trying to stop it, you joined it? Increasingly, there are only 2 basic human types populating this planet, Land wrote in 2013. There are autistic nerds, who alone are capable of participating effectively in the advanced technological processes that characterize the emerging economy. And there is everybody else. For everybody else, this situation is uncomfortable. On a recent Tuesday night, about 100 people gathered at a Mediterranean revival mansion in San Francisco to celebrate Land's arrival in the city from Shanghai, where he moved in the early 2000s. It was clear which of the 2 basic human types most of the people in the room could be categorized into. David Holtz, the founder of the image-generating AI program Midjourney, was the party's host. On stage, Land wore loose jeans and a dark baggy sweater with holes in the cuffs. The thought occurred to me that it might very well be the same one from his Warwick days when he was wont to describe himself as, quote, a palsied mantis constructed from black jumpers and secondhand Sega circuitry, stalking the crumbling corridors of academe, systematically extirpating all humanism, end quote. Despite his avowed desire to turn himself into a Terminator, the human remains. Land is still, as his former students remember him, preternaturally polite. This was his first public appearance in the U.S. since 2016, and he had been flown in by Richard Crabe, the South American-born founder of Numerai, a hedge fund whose trades are made by AI. The crowd skewed young and male, with long hair and sweatshirts or crew cuts and blue blazers. The women, for the most part, were either wearing miniskirts or caring for children. Land had spent the week meeting with people in tech, and he was thrilled by what he had seen. "Everyone seems to be doing amazing things," he said. At Numerai, Crabe told me, Land was particularly taken with the chief data officer, who was working full tilt to eliminate his own job and replace himself with AI. The last time Land had been in San Francisco was in the mid-90s, and the woke nanny state dystopia he remembered was gone, replaced by something like its opposite. The AI revolution wasn't just about creating new software. This was holy, holy, holy capitalism, the final breakout of capital I, non-human intelligence from the fetters of democratic containment. Land has always been a controversial figure, but not for the same reasons he is now. In the 90s, at Warwick, he led the Cybernetic Culture Research Unit, or CCRU, a crew of graduate students, artists, and philosophers who saw in digital technology portents of revolution. Narrowly construed, cybernetics is the science behind digital computing. But the CCRU saw in it a vaster vision of self-regulating, auto-catalyzing processes. Computing, they argued, was not just a technology, but the secret of the universe. The system underpinning genetics, market economics, thermodynamics. Burrowed in a sleepy university town, fueled by amphetamines, rave music, and the end of history euphoria of the early internet, They hemmed a future that would eventually lead to superintelligent AI, societal collapse, and human extinction. Monkey flake, that is, humanity, was mere grist for the coming machines. Enthralled to visions of virtual apocalypse, Land soon saw his life fall apart. The CCRU lost its funding, and Land lost his job. Other CCRU alumni, such as Mark Fisher, who became an influential critic of neoliberalism, eventually softened their stance, arguing that technology should be harnessed to build a more just and equitable future. But Land swerved hard to the right. In the 90s, he had told his students that the future would take place in China. In the early 2000s, he surfaced in Shanghai, working as a journalist and travel guide editor. He wrote articles in praise of the war on terror and posted about flash-frying Islamofascists in the comments sections of neoconservative blogs. In his earliest work, Land had advocated feminist violence and the overthrowing of logic and patriarchy. Now, he wanted to squash democratic myths and restructure governments as authoritarian city-states ruled by computers. Land's vision shares much with that of Yarvin, whom he describes as a hero and whose writings were the subject of Land's Dark Enlightenment essay. Yarvin's blueprint for a post-democratic future centers on the idea that states should be reconstituted as businesses, or, as he calls them, SovCorps, spelled SovCorps. Yarvin was there that Tuesday night, making a much-anticipated appearance. As the ballroom filled up, he walked in, wearing a natty tweed jacket and sunglasses. That evening was the first time that the two titans of neo-reactionary thought would meet, and yet, when Yarvin joined Land on the stage, they didn't seem to have much to say to each other. Yarvin tends to extreme digression, while Land speaks with the elusive compression of a guru. The conversation struggled to get traction. Was AI accelerating or slowing down? Would we all become managers of our own LLM armies? As Yarvin free associated on Venezuela, the resource curse, and the future of graphic designers, verdict not looking good, Land waited patiently, seeming a little bored. Yarvin speculated that after all jobs had been automated, perhaps people could make money selling their organs. But our new robot overlords do not need human organs, Land reminded him before opening the floor. Once upon a time, the attendees of an event like the one that took place the other week might have shied away from being associated with a figure like Land. But that night, there was no sense of scandal or secrecy. The event had been organized by a man named Wolf Tivy, the founder of a futurist magazine rumored to be funded by the libertarian entrepreneur Peter Thiel. Tivy declined to confirm Thiel as a funding source, and said the magazine's funding is now entirely subscriber-based. 5 years ago, I would have said, get the F out, Tivy responded when I told him I was writing for The New Yorker. Now, everything's different. Tivy was right. In February 2020, as the COVID pandemic loomed, I attended an event for Yarvin in Los Angeles, hosted by the podcaster Justin Murphy, at a defunct veterans lodge in a gentrifying neighborhood. At that point, Murphy had recently quit academia to pursue podcasts and had rented an Airbnb in the hopes of creating a TikTok hype house for dissident intellectuals. The event was Yarvin's first public appearance since 2016, when other participants withdrew from a tech conference he was speaking at because of his advocacy of monarchism. There is a huge demand for this, true, radical, dangerous intellectual thought and discussion, Murphy said when introducing him. As attendees chatted over pizza and Jack Daniels, Thiel slipped in through the back door, joining the hipsters on folding chairs. Do it yourself, baby, punk rock, Murphy said. Get a venue where you live. Put on things like this. The institutions aren't going to do it for you. 6 years later, Yarvin is openly feted by tech founders and cited as an influence by the vice president. land can now hold court in the ballroom of a mansion where sushi and seltzer are being served. Clearly, these ideas and the political energy that they carry have escaped containment. But now, having spread, the new reactionary thought seems to have lost some of its momentum. "Nobody knows where we're going," Garvin said on the stage. Land agreed, adding, "I think the thing is that muddling through is the world that we are now living in." Afterward, I found Murphy chatting with a group outside. He seemed almost shocked by Land and Yarvin's conversation. "They sounded like old fogies," he said, while smoking tobacco from a pipe. "We'll remember this night as proof that the dark enlightenment is over. Think about what's happened since then. Machine intelligence has been solved. Woke is over. Trump is back. Crypto is institutionalized. Everyone is still in this besieged mentality, but the bars have been lifted." Land's writings from the 90s have a seductive danger, envisioning a sci-fi future of synthetic drugs, black market brain implants, gene editing, and cyborgs. At that time, a world of true digital immersion was still decades away. Like William Gibson, who wrote the 80s cyberpunk classic Neuromancer on a typewriter, Land, in his CCRU heyday, had a green-screen Amstrad computer and was barely connected to the Internet. But now, a version of Land's midnight future has arrived. While real-world infrastructure is left to rot, AI build-out floats the economy, accounting, as of 2025, for almost 40% of U.S. GDP growth. And many of the fantasies that powered the online right during the mid-2010s have become official policy under the second Trump administration. The president hired the world's wealthiest tech mogul to dismantle the government. The Department of Homeland Security posts deportation videos on TikTok that resemble the fast wave fan edits once spread on meme accounts inspired by Land and Yarvin. Out-of-control AI is not a fiction imagined by novelists, but a reality financed by venture capitalists and sovereign wealth funds. And you no longer have to go to the deepest crypts of the web to find Land. In October, on an episode of Tucker Carlson's show, seen by millions, Carlson and the self-described amateur theologian Conrad Flynn discussed Land's ideas about AI for close to half an hour. "We are building the demons from the book of Revelation with AI," Flynn explained, summarizing Land. "That's Nick Land's position?" Carlson asked. "It's the position of a lot of these guys," Flynn replied. Late in the evening, after Land's conversation with Yarvin, a procession followed Land onto a deck overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The group's average age could not have been much older than 25. Many mentioned working for various AI majors, OpenAI, Anthropic, Midjourney. Everyone sat down around a fire pit, except for Land, who stood, face lit from below, gesturing and swaying. The crowd was admiring, even starstruck, but their questions did not suggest particularly right-wing sympathies. The conversation had the tenor of a campfire chat you have when you're young and stoned. Questions about the universe and human destiny discussed in the vaguest possible terms. Unlike most such conversations, though, this one was conducted by people whose actions may very well determine the course of history. I was struck by how unsure these tech workers seemed of the world they were building. They looked to Land as a prophet. Now that his vision was coming true, they wanted to know what was next. Despite the about-face in Land's political alignment between his CCRU and Dark Enlightenment years, what has remained the same is a scorn for the things our species holds dear. "Nothing human makes it out of the near future," he proclaimed in Meltdown, the talk from 1994, which has since become legendary. As the night wore on, the line kept coming up. "If humanity is doomed," someone asked, as Yarvin's baby started crying, "what's the point of politics? What is the point," someone else asked him, "of having children?" Land has two college-age kids who he doesn't think have read his work. At the fire pit, the musician Grimes sat beside Land. Grimes has long engaged with accelerationist ideas in her music, and she has three children with Elon Musk, whom Steve Bannon has called one of the top accelerationists. After the party, Musk wrote on X that he unfortunately missed the event. Her song, We Appreciate Power, includes the lyrics, Pledge allegiance to the world's most powerful computer. Simulation, it's the future. And she has also created an open source AI platform for generating music with her voice. But that night, she seemed to hesitate. What will happen, she asked Land, when AI becomes self-improving and humans get locked out of the loop of their development? Can the machines be oriented toward human ends? Or will AI simply eat the universe? I feel an incredible urge to make it stop and see beauty more, she said. Land's reply took a predictable form. The true engine of history, he explained, is the feedback loop between commerce and technology, money and power. Human desire is just a vessel, worked from the outside toward ends we cannot control. History has a destination, but it is not for humans. My prediction is that AI will persuade you that technology eating the universe is more beautiful, he said. As usual, I'll end with some poetry. First up, from the January 12th, 2026 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Approaching Sundown by Jory Graham. There is a suddenness to all surfaces. In the fields, forwardness is ensnared and all stops. The lawn is a god. A door in the trees opens. Corridors appear everywhere as light, and the light says, you want to live, and nothing happens. The lowering light gathers in the waste of the day. It glows on bark, on chips of rock, and right there in the upcurl of the dried leaf on that blue chair, and also there on the live leaf at the branch tip of that young oak, which had just moments ago sashayed in bits of wind and is now brutal in its stillness. A towhee flies off and leaves behind this. We do not exhale. It is possible consciousness disappears from the atmosphere, taking with it the crazed minutes running towards the end, only because they were let loose once. And you cannot strip away this skin which holds you in. You cannot hide from the rush which will start up again as soon as you exhale. But for now, pain wakens to find itself not pain. Whatever is hatching us is done and falls away, and we are dropped down. The incubation is suddenly over. That anything occurred before is erased. Do not forget this when you return to that world where the casting about of the soul which lives in the shadows begins again, where the leaves swirl up into the twisting torso of the wind, which wants once again to peer in all the other directions, where the cicadas, which had stopped unexpectedly, as the promiscuity of glancing had stopped, as wanting and knowing had begin again. But for now, for the impossible eternity of this second, whatever there is, which is all there is, stands unbroken before us. Next, from the January 16 and 23rd issue of the New Yorker, Ode 1 by Ricardo Ruiz. Master, how serene are all the hours we waste. If, as we waste them, we place them in a vase like flowers. There are no sorrows in our lives, No joys either. Let us learn then, innocent sages, not to live life, but to pass through it, tranquil, serene, taking children as our teachers, eyes full of nature. Beside a river, beside a road, wherever we are, living life with the same light ease. Time passes and tells us nothing. We grow old. Let us learn, almost mischievously, to feel ourselves leaving. There is no point in doing anything. There is no resisting the monstrous God who devours his own children. Let us gather flowers. Let us bathe our hands in the calm rivers, and from them learn their calm. Sunflowers eternally staring at the sun, we will leave life tranquilly, not even regretting having lived. And now, also from the February 16th, February 23rd, 2026 issue of The New Yorker, A Very Small Snowflake by Han Kang. A very small snowflake, you, as if dancing, as if slowly dancing, approach my face. Instead of falling straight down like all the other snowflakes, somehow you spread your wings toward my face. But where did you get to after that? I never saw you again. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website again is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.